Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
I got a lot for you here today. First of all, new Trump advertisement just landed. Kamala is for they, them. President Trump is for you. I think this is a good ad, and I'll tell you what, there are more parents out there who are afraid of... And by the way, Matt, we're going to be able to also add video clips to YouTube soon, too, right? That's our plan as well.
Yeah, we'll have everything. If you watch the morning show, basically that's...
Shh, don't say that out loud.
What? People are familiar with it.
No, I'm saying we don't want to...
Oh, no.
We're not going to be copying anything.
No, we're not going to copy it, obviously.
We would never do that. Like, for example, like what's on the cut sheet, we would never... Anyway.
We don't have that anymore.
Right.
I know mystery movie clip, that's gone.
Or prizes.
Yeah, I guess the mystery movie clip doesn't much matter if we don't have anything to give away with it.
No, because you go, congratulations, you won nothing. Or you go, you won bragging rights, which is great, right?
That only goes so far.
Bragging rights. This is a new Trump ad that just came out. Cut 23.
Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners.
Surgery.
For prisoners.
For prisoners. Every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access.
It's hard to believe, but it's true. Even the liberal media was shocked Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners and illegal aliens.
Every transgender inmate would have access.
Kamala's for they, them. President Trump is for you.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
It's a good ad. Believe me, this matters more with parents than you realize. I'm telling you, they're very, very worried about the indoctrination of their kids and everything else. Plus, also this whole idea of paying for transgender surgeries for prisoners. I mean, it's just insane. That's as wacky lefty as you get. And it shows you how wacky lefty Kamala Harris truly is. This is fascinating to me. So as part of Kamala Harris's word salads on Oprah last night, she was asked a question regarding, well, this is basically her clothes. You know, this is our clothes. And the problem that Kamala Harris has, I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. She doesn't have the intelligence level to be able to think on her feet. Now, I'm not saying she's a dumb person. She's not. She's clearly a smart individual. She has a law degree. She's attorney general. She's vice president. I'm not saying she's a dumb person. I'm saying she lacks the intelligence factor to be able to think on your feet. Not everybody has it. You know, I'm better thinking on my feet than I am when I prepare, obviously, as you know from doing the show. It's a different way your mind works. She doesn't have the ability to think on her feet, which is probably why, as a prosecutor, she didn't really try many cases. She had her underlings try cases, because to be a good prosecutor in a courtroom, you got to be witty and quick and fast, and you got to be able to think on your feet. Kamala Harris does not have that ability. She lacks that ability to do that. So every answer has to be pre-scripted. Every answer has to be rehearsed. Every answer has to be, let's try that again. Let's do that again. And I'm telling you, the more you do that with people, the more robotic it sounds. And it sounds more inauthentic. So Oprah Winfrey asked Kamala Harris last night, you know, what is on your heart to say to the American people? This is the close. This is your moment now with Oprah and a friendly crowd and a softball interview to just crush it. To crush it. Instead, she gets platitudes. And the way I want to describe it to you is, there's often a saying when it comes to speeches. A lot of times you don't remember what the speaker said. You remember how they made you feel. And that's one way to go about it. But a really good speaker, you remember how the person made you feel, and you remember what they said. They imparted something on you that you took with you when you left. I guarantee you, when you listen to this, there's nothing Kamala Harris said here that you would actually walk out with and impart upon you and say, yeah, you know what? I want to be burdened by what I just heard. Nope, you want to unburden yourself from the burden of what you just heard. So here is Kamala Harris on a 2-minute philosophical word salad. I'm not going to play the whole thing complete. Don't worry. Cut number 4.
What is on your heart to say to the American people as we have 47 days until November 5th. What's on your heart? To say to particularly those people who are still undecided or maybe indifferent or on the fence still.
We love our country. I love our country. I know we all do. That's why everybody's here right now. We love our country. We take pride in the privilege of being American. And this is a moment where we can and must come together as Americans.
Stop. This is painful, right? It's painful. And you know why it's painful for me as a media trainer? It's painful for me as a guy who used to do this with candidates, because this is the nightmare scenario. The nightmare scenario when you've done your best. You've done your... You know what it's like? I'll give you... It's like you got a doctor who's got a patient who just wants to lose... Like, can't lose weight, whatever. And you're the doctor and you're sitting there and you're watching this person go up to the buffet three times. And you go, what? Why are you coming in? I don't understand. I'm doing everything for you. I'm giving you my best. And you're going back to the dessert bar for a third time. What are you doing? That's what it feels like as a media trainer when you've got a bad candidate deliver an answer like this. You go, we worked on this. We did this. What are you doing right now? What is this word salad? We practiced this. You're supposed to talk about how you're going to help people make more money and better economy. And what are you doing with we love our country and wah? It's the worst. I'm telling you, it's like the worst feeling as a media trainer that you could possibly be. You know, it's the equivalent of like a guy who trains you how to parachute out of a plane. And then you jump out and it's like, would you pull the freaking ripcord? Pull it. And you go, why are you just going to plummet to your death? We practiced this. Pull it. Get away from the cannolis. Step away from the dessert bar. That's what it's like. You sit there and go, and then finally you go, I've done everything for this person. There's nothing I can do. I can't do it anymore. I'm out. And you go, that's it. This is it. This campaign's going to lose. I guarantee you they rehearsed with her a closing line and they practiced it with her and they said, okay. And she's so bad at this that she kept practicing it. And the more she practiced, she sounds more robotic and more inauthentic. And it's just the kind of thing where you go, I think I feel good hearing this, but I don't remember why, because there's nothing of substance for you to take home with you after it ends. So you get that sugary feeling of like, oh, I think I feel good. I don't know why I feel good. And you don't remember a word of what she said. That's the approach right here. All right, keep going.
We can and must come together as Americans, understanding we have so much more in common than what separates us. Let's come together with the character that we are so proud of about who we are, which is we are an optimistic people.
Stop. And again, you go, what? Come together with the character of the people we are. We are an optimistic people. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? What is this? Talk about the economy. Get back to the, you're going to help people. And then, and I've been in those situations. I'm telling you, I've been in those situations with bad candidates. It's painful. It's painful. Because you know, you're like, and okay, now, come on, talk to me about the American dream, bringing people, getting the inflation down. You're going to go make it, All right, keep going.
Optimistic people. Americans, by character, are people who have dreams and ambitions and aspirations.
What?
We believe in what is possible. We believe in what can be. And we believe in fighting for that. That's how we came into being. Because the people before us understood that one of the greatest expressions for the love of our country, one of the greatest expressions of patriotism, is to fight for the ideals of who we are.
Okay,
which
this is
freedom.
Stop. This is all a philosophical pablum. I don't know what this is. I guess it would be something that maybe somebody in a philosophy class would say, the people who came before us and what? James Carville's blood pressure must have been about 190 over 107. I don't know blood pressure numbers, but high. Both high. You know what I mean? You imagine Carver last night? I guarantee you he's dropping F-bombs. Raging Cajun F-bombs last night as he's watching this going, would you talk about the economy? It's all about optimistic people, philosophical. What is this philosophical nonsense? But she doesn't have the ability. She can't do it. See, that's the problem. She can't do it. Oh, now I'm only going to play this to the end because Oprah's reaction at the end tells you everything. All right. So let's keep going here.
Is to fight for the ideals of who we are, which includes freedom to make decisions about your own body, freedom to be safe from gun violence, freedom to have access to the ballot box, freedom to be who you are and just be, to love who you love openly and with pride, freedom to just be. And that's...
Did you hear Oprah?
Who we are. We believe in all that.
You know what, Oprah? You know what that was? I just wanted you to hear that part. And you go back to that part. That, You know what that was? That's Oprah Winfrey going, you're not Barack Obama. You're not Michelle Obama. You are terrible. You are bad at this. You are bad. That's what that was right there. That was Oprah's tell. Oprah's got a tell, and that's what it was. Remember, Oprah Winfrey backed Barack Obama before he ran for president. She said back in 2007... If Barack Obama runs for president, I will support him. And she did. And Barack Obama was very good. He's a good politician. So is Michelle Obama. She's a very good politician. These are good politicians, right? They know how to communicate. They know how to talk. They can answer things on their feet. Kamala Harris is not that. And what you heard there with Oprah was that, you suck at this. That's what Oprah was saying with that, Because it wasn't like she heard anything profound. It wasn't like she heard anything groundbreaking. That's what Oprah Winfrey's tell was right there. Listen to it one more time. Go ahead.
Freedom to have access to the ballot box. Freedom to be who you are and just be. To love who you love openly and with pride. Freedom to just be.
That's Oprah. You know what that is? That's the best you got? To love who you love? What year is this? What the hell? What are you running for the LGBTQ plus IA, every letter of the alphabet chair at college? Or are you running for president of the United States? The freedom to love who you love. The freedom to just be. The freedom to... Oprah's thinking, you are bad at this. This is bad. This is bad. That's exactly what that was from Oprah Winfrey. Don't doubt me on this. I'm telling you. And I wish we could show you her body language, but soon we will. And I'll be excited about that when that happens, because that's good, because we will get there. All right. This is our happy hour brought to you by the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey. We'll be back there live October 11th. It's going to be a wonderful day. Friday, October 11th. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'd love to have you join us for that. Friday, October 11th at my happy place, the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey. We will have a lot of fun, and let's do that. So mark your calendar for that, okay? Mark your calendar and be there. I don't want you to miss it. All right. So this comedian, Danny Jokes, put out an AI version of CNN's Jake Tapper talking about... This is terrible. This is not funny. This is really not funny, Matt DeSantis. I'm surprised you put this in the show sheet.
It's a little bit funny.
I am.
Before we play it.
Yeah.
I just want to say this.
Yes.
I know you have a tendency to interrupt clips. The highlight is like the last 30 seconds. So you gotta wait.
All right. I promise. I'm actually literally, when you play this, I'm going to turn my microphone off.
It's for the best.
Okay. The executive producer putting the host in his place right there. Don't interrupt the clip. Let it play out. All right, so we're going to do that. So this is Danny Jokes. Put this together. It's artificial intelligence. It's Jake Tapper. I'm muting my mic.
Another shocking story coming out of Lebanon that's breaking right now. 2 days ago, pagers belonging to members of Hezbollah were simultaneously detonated. And yesterday, walkie-talkies all over the country began exploding in another wave of what appears to be Israeli retaliations. But just moments ago, in a truly surreal twist, the rectums of goats all over the country exploded at the same time, killing an additional 1,800 people and injuring thousands of others, as well as killing countless goats. CNN International News correspondent Kevin Brown is following the story on the ground in Tel Aviv. Kevin, it's good to see you because everyone was following the pager and walkie-talkie story. And now this happens. What else can you tell us about this developing story?
Thanks, Jake. Tensions are running high right now all over Lebanon as everything seems to be exploding, leaving members of Hezbollah scrambling. First it was the pager bombs, yesterday walkie-talkies, and now we're hearing just in the last hour it's the goats that are exploding, leading to skyrocketing death tolls. While it's still speculative, it's hard to believe that the IDF isn't behind all of these incidents. Now it appears explosive devices were somehow placed in the rectums of goats all throughout the country, and when the Hezbollah members began having relations with the goats, the devices were set off. This action will be a massive blow to the morale of Hezbollah, as this was their main method of letting off steam. And now that the goats can't be trusted, they may have to resort to yucky intercourse with women. Back to you, Jake.
Kevin Brown live from Tel Aviv with that developing story. PETA has just issued a statement denouncing the actions of the IDF for senselessly killing all those goats. However, you'd have to think, if the IDF was behind this, they may have been doing those goats a huge favor.
That's just, I mean, that is just insane. That's that crazy right there. Wow. I denounced that. We should never should have played that on the show. That was terrible.
That thing is so funny.
Terrible. We're definitely getting a memo. We're definitely getting a memo on Monday.
It was really well done, too.
It was, I mean, the only reason we play that is to show you how AI has come so far with deepfakes, and that would be illegal in California because of Gavin Newsom.
Gavin Newsom would arrest us.
Gavin Newsom would arrest Danny Jokes for putting that together. That's all I'm saying right there. Oh, hey, we're one of the rudest cities in America. Look at us. Philadelphia coming in.
Number two,
rudest city in America. Boom. What's number one?
Miami.
Screw them. We'll be number one again. Well, you know, the problem is nobody wants to come to Philly anymore because of all the crime. As soon as crime goes down, we'll be number one in rudeness again. Damn right.
Is Miami that rude?
Nah, Miami's not rude. It's just the problem. It's snobby, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it makes sense.
But politics played a factor. A staggering one in two Americans thinks residents of their city have become more rude ahead of the upcoming election. Overall, the most commonly observed rude behaviors were a lack of care for others, noisiness in public, and a lack of self-awareness. I'll tell you what I can't stand people doing. This new thing I've seen now, people talking on speakerphone, walking through a store on speakerphone, having a conversation. Have you seen this?
Oh, it's horrible.
It's horrible, right?
Yeah. I mean, get a pair of AirPods or something.
Yeah. Get a pair of AirPods or do like what everybody else used to do and hold the phone up to your freaking ear. How about that? Maybe are they afraid it's going to explode? Like, do they think it's Hezbollah? Like, what's going on?
You know what? I retract my statement. I don't like the AirPod people either, because sometimes I'll hear someone say like, oh, what's going on, man? I'll turn and say, oh, how are you?
Yeah.
And you know what? Guy wasn't even talking to me. He's got his AirPods in. And then he looks at me as though I've interrupted his conversation.
The only benefit to having AirPods in is that you can pretend like you're on a call for somebody you don't want to talk to that comes over to you. Be like,
that's
oh, sorry, I'm on a call. It's the only benefit statement to that, you know?
The AirPod Maxes are great, too, because people recognize those are noise canceling. Like, if you're sitting in the airport and somebody sits down next to you, you're waiting to board, somebody chatty, they want to talk to you, you just keep those AirPod Maxes in and make it seem as though you can't hear anything they're saying. I've done it several times myself.
Oh, that's beautiful, because I hate talking to people at airports or on planes. Hate it.
It's the worst.
So I need to get a pair of those. I don't have a pair of those.
They're great.
What are they called? The AirPod what?
AirPod Maxes.
Oh, I'm buying them right now.
They're genuinely noise canceling as well. If you don't want to hear the person, you can make it happen.
Well, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because somebody, I remember I was flying back from Chicago and I sat down next to somebody and I was pretty sure they were a wacko liberal. And they said something like, do you hate Trump? And I was like, you know, I'm good. I think I'm just going to sit back here and no habla español. I don't speak it English. As I started rolling out my Italian accent, you know, I just got here from Napoli. I don't know. You remember that Uber driver?
Oh, that was the worst. He kept trying to get us to voice a political opinion.
So we're in Milwaukee, and they have this whole Uber zone. Was it Milwaukee or Milwaukee,
that was
right?
Milwaukee, yeah.
They have an Uber zone. You got to go outside of the perimeter, and we get into this Uber, and this guy says to us, do you remember the first thing he said?
He said, so you guys here for the convention? Yeah. The answer was obviously yes.
Yes.
And he said, so what do you think of Donald Trump?
Right.
But before we could even answer, he voiced his opinion on Donald Trump.
Yeah.
It was not a good one.
And I said, you know what, sir? We're journalists. We don't have an opinion. And then he just starts teeing off on Trump. He's like, but what do you really think about him? I was like, yeah, no, we're just not unbiased. I'm an unbiased journalist. I think I literally said that. I go, we're unbiased journalists, sir. We have no political opinion whatsoever. Nothing.
He hit us with that line a couple times. We're like, off the record. You can tell me what you really think of Donald Trump.
You can really let us know. He's like, you're not Trump people, are you? I'm like, oh, that's going to be a fun ride. So I just shut it down right there because this guy's driving and I don't want to make this guy angry. And then he was annoyed that we wouldn't talk to him because he didn't say a word after that. Finally, he shut up. But we had about a 20-minute car ride back to our crappy, bedbug-infested hotel. That's probably where the lice came from, was that friggin' disgusting hotel that we stayed at.
I had a roach in my room.
Yeah, you did.
If there's one roach, there's got to be other roaches. I just couldn't find them.
I'm just saying. I need to get the noise-canceling headphone. That's good. Or I just go, I'm from Philly. We're the number two rootest city. Shut up. I don't want to talk to you. Just do that. This is a brand new portion of Gutfeld's interview with Trump that never aired. They didn't air this part, so you haven't heard this yet. This is really cool because Trump was on Gutfeld the other night, talks about his high school experience and whether or not he's ever been heartbroken. Cut number six.
So last night we had so many great moments with Donald Trump that we couldn't fit it all into one show, hence the lube. Here's that part you didn't get to see. What is your fondest and not so fondest memory of high school?
I loved high school. I loved sports in high school. I loved playing sports. I had a couple of things where you get in a little trouble. I was aggressive. By the way, when you look at the aggression of kids in schools today, where they throw teachers out the window, we're not talking about that. But I hated getting in trouble because I hated when they call my father and mother and say, you know, he's not really behaving so well. I hated it. But I loved the camaraderie. I had a lot of great friends from high school.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see him often, but one came up to my office the other day. He was a great looking guy. Women loved him. Most beautiful looking guy you've ever seen. And I hadn't seen him in many years. And I said to the people in the office, the women especially, when you see this guy, how he looks. He was a football player. He was a great football player, actually. But he had everything. And the women loved him. And he walked into my office. And I said, oh. It was not a pretty sight. Man, did he take a beating. Now, he may look at me and say, he hasn't aged well.
Yes.
But this guy has not aged well, but he was a nice guy anyway.
I got one last question. Has your heart ever been broken?
Oh, wow. That's such a question. I hate to admit it. Am I allowed to admit it?
Yes.
No. Well, I mean, look, I've had situations where it was devastating.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to use the word broken. I just can't do that. I'm your president. I'm not supposed to.
Thank you.
I'm not supposed to have a heart that's broken.
Fred, he's not sitting in my chair.
Very good. Very good. He's really good in those situations. He's got a natural charm and wit about him. He's very good. Kamala Harris could never, ever pull that off. And that's the problem for her. Anyway, great for Trump. It's fantastic for Trump because he's just natural in that environment. He's really good. He loves to just talk and be one of the guys and just have a great time. And then you have the scripted robot giving her scripted word salad answers and sounding so inauthentic and so inhuman. And that's why, you know, they had a focus group of undecided voters in Georgia. They all say that the economy was better under Donald Trump and they think Kamala Harris is weak. The focus group was conducted by the Daily Mail pollster. And some notable quotes from the focus group. These are black voters in Georgia. If you look at the statistics now, we're far worse now than we were before. Everything is worse now with Biden and Harris. Even though Trump didn't make all the right choices, the economy just worked better under him. I think it was the overall business mindset that helped. She kept saying that she's a warrior, but I don't think she's a warrior. If you put her next to Michelle Obama or Hillary Clinton, it's like there's no comparison. They would eat her up. Remember I said to you before, that's what Oprah was thinking. When Oprah said that, she was thinking that. You are no Michelle Obama. And she was thinking the Democrats have really made a bad mistake with this choice of candidate. But here's a little bit from the focus group. Take a listen.
Hand up if you think the economy is better under Trump. And hands up if you think the economy is better under Biden and Harris.
Why?
Okay, 7-1.
7-1.
That's pretty clear.
The truth. I'm not saying he's like, of course, yeah, like I dare say he has best. He still has a business mindset. I think that lended somewhat. And I think, yes, the trickle down of whatever previous stuff. And I think he just handles certain things a little better.
Who does?
Trump.
Led?
He provided more jobs, more opportunities, stimulus. Even though he didn't have any experience in politics, but he came in and did a much better job. If you look at the statistics now, we're far more worse now than we were before.
Firstly, I just want to ask a general question about Harris. Then we're going to show some clips from the debate. What's your biggest hesitation about voting for Kamala Harris?
Just, is she going to be able to do the things that she says she's going to be able to do? That's, you know what I mean? Just, is she going to be able to do it? That's my big hesitation. Is she going to be able to get it past Congress? You know what I'm saying? I don't know. Yep. You know.
Mikhail, how about you?
Everything that glitters ain't gold.
Yeah, for sure.
It looks great on paper. But I'm not sure it could translate to politics and if she'll even be able to get it passed.
Hayward?
My thing is her strength. And that's my focus for her. You know, is she going to be able to take a punch and give one or two back? You know, that's my biggest thing. And it has nothing to do with her gender, ladies, okay? But we're talking about the highest office in the land.
Yeah. If it was Michelle Obama, I would feel totally different.
Yeah, You can't be weak and hold that office.
Yeah, like if you put her next to Michelle Obama, it's like...
Or Hillary Clinton.
Or Hillary Clinton, it's like it's no comparison on the strength that I think Michelle Obama is going to have against her. They would eat her up.
How did Harris come across then? How did she do up against him? Hayward says that, you know, big personality. How did she do? How did she come across?
She kept saying that she's a warrior and she's going to fight for her. I don't know if you're a strong ass. I mean, I get it what you feel, but I don't think you are as like a warrior, like fighter, like she
right,
says she is.
Right.
That's just my opinion. Not that I don't think she doesn't care. And like I said, she used a lot of appealing to emotion, like anecdotal, like anecdotal evidence instead of like, you know, she used some facts, but just like to like appeal to people like, hey, you know, I'm just like, you know, so you try to get people on her side.
Oh, I don't think the bar was set pretty high when it comes to that. When it comes to her speaking, I believe the last debate with Biden set it really low. So I believe she did a lot better than Biden. But that's pretty much what I got in them.
They're both old. And Biden is old. Trump is old.
We need to get some
young folks in there that knows, you know, have an idea of what's going on now.
So this is just, you know, it's a great example of what I'm telling you, which is that, you know, don't believe the hype here. This is they are not sold on this candidate. No way, shape or form. The man, the myth, the legend, the legendary Jack Carr is going to be my guest next. He's got a brand new book out about the bombing of our embassy in Lebanon. We're going to talk to him about that straight ahead as we continue along here with the show. And what am I doing here, Matt? Anything? Am I doing anything?
We could talk about the top story of the day.
Oh, big story of the day brought to you by our buddy, Dr. Mike Vanaria, VanariaDental.com. Go see him today for your perfect smile. VANARIA, VanariaDental.com, 856-786-2020, or visit VanariaDental.com, VanariaDental.com. My buddy, my dentist, and the master of dental implants, Dr. Mike Vanaria. All right, we'll be right back. Jack Carr joins me next. Don't go away.
It's the 5 o'clock happy hour. on the Rich Zeoli Show. Brought to you by the Oceanfront Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey, a premier full-service resort and conference center. GrandHotelCapeMay.com.
No, no, you need a badass song for Jack Carr. We're going to bring Jack Carr on, Navy SEAL. This guy's a sniper. Navy SEAL sniper. You got to give me something better than that, than like 70s love music. I don't know what that was. Give me something ass-kicking for the guy who's the number one New York Times international best-selling author, the man behind two Amazon Prime shows, a guy who's got his own whiskey line, cigar line, and now his first nonfiction book. Jack Carr, my man!
Oh, it's so great to be here, and that's exactly what I thought when I heard that music. I said, what is going on over there at this show?
What's going on here? Justin, you're making me look bad. Come on, give me something ass-kicking for Jack Carr.
I got you.
There we go.
What operation are you guys running over there?
I know, right? This is embarrassing. I'm embarrassed for you. Play it. Go ahead. Let's go. There we go.
The ads are killing me here.
Oh, the ads with the ads. Jack, by the way, I got a bottle
that's
in my hand here.
Jump in.
Jack Carr. What's that?
You did, we got a bottle of what?
I got my in my hands right now my Jack Carr Warrior Proof American Whiskey that you sent me. Thank you so much for that. I got my hat on right now, and I smoked all the cigars you sent me. But that was so nice of you to do. All right, go ahead, play some Jack. Give me some music. Go ahead. What do you think of this, Jack? Is that better?
That's better. That's better.
All right. Not bad.
That's better.
Better than whatever that was before.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Justin.
A little slow. I was thinking maybe some Thunderstruck or something like that.
Yeah, give me a little AC/DC.
Funny enough, that was before. That was what I was going to.
Well, that's what you should have done instead of, I don't know, Barry Manilow or whatever. Don't worry about it now. Jack, you got a new brand new.
Trust your gut.
You got a brand new book out. It's your first foray into nonfiction. Congratulations on that. Your amazing success in all the fiction books that you've written, the James Reese series. But now it's a brand new chapter for Jack Carr, I guess.
It is. And I'm certainly not the first one to do it. And from the fan perspective, I was well aware that Tom Clancy started out with Hunt for Red October and then moved into Red Storm Rising and then Patriot Games and Cardinal of the Kremlin and Clear and Present Danger. And then he moves into the 90s and he starts doing nonfiction. And I weave a lot of history into the pages of my novels as it is, talk about historical events, particularly terrorist events, on my social media. And it was a natural transition. I always knew that I would go into the nonfiction space at some point or add that to what I was doing. And then when I thought I'd built up enough political capital with Simon & Schuster, I gave him the pitch and said, I want to start a nonfiction series that looks at different terrorist events and pulls out the strategic, operational, and tactical level lessons while also humanizing those events. And I don't want these to be pop history, meaning I don't want to just go out and read a bunch of more books on terrorism and then kind of regurgitate those and then kind of add my analysis. I wanted this to be primary sources. I wanted this to be interviews because in the case of Beirut 1983, there are a lot of people that are still alive that were there at the time of the event. And so I wanted to make this an actual work of history. So I worked with an amazing guy, James Scott, Pulitzer Prize finalist, historian on this, and could not be more pleased with how it came out. So it is out there on Tuesday.
Congratulations. Targeted Beirut by Jack Carr. This is an amazing time. The 1983 Marine Barracks bombing and the untold origin story of the war on terror. So immediately I got captured by that, Jack Carr. I said, wait, so this is really where it all begins? This war on terror that we're still fighting today? This is the origin story, huh?
This is it. And I kept when I pitched Simon & Schuster, I wrote down about three pages of different terrorist events from the end of World War II up to the time I talked to Simon & Schuster about it, which is about 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And I kept coming back to Beirut 1983 because, of course, there were terrorist events before that, terrorist events even involving the United States, hostage taking like the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis. But that was more murky, meaning it didn't set the rules for what was to come. It didn't set the paradigm and the model that we'd be operating from ever since. But Beirut 1983 did, and it started with the embassy bombing in April of that year and then really culminates with that knockout punch in October 23rd of 1983, where 241 U.S. servicemen are killed, 220 Marines, 18 sailors, and 3 soldiers. And Iran set those rules through proxies. So through proxy forces, and they've been operating by those rules. And really, the United States and Israel have been operating by those rules as well. So that's why it's really the opening salvo of this war on terror, because it sets the model that all of those countries will be operating from that day forward.
Why were we in Lebanon at that time, Jack?
This is the big question of the book, and there is not really a good answer for it. People continue to ask that question today, and not just about Beirut and Lebanon back in the 80s, but for other interventionist policies in places that the United States military is around the globe today. So they went in as peacekeepers. These Marines who are trained up to go in, crush an enemy, and come home, they are thrown into a tactically disadvantageous and untenable position, meaning they're supposed to keep the peace between government forces, between militias, Sunni, Shia, Druze, Mennonites, all of these different factions that also have other factions based on neighborhoods. So it is an impossible position that they're put in back then. Very similar parallel to us leaving Afghanistan in 2021, putting our troops at Abbey Gate in a tactically disadvantageous position when we had one that was more tactically advantageous in Bagram. And in the case of Abbey Gate, we have 13 Americans killed, others wounded, dealing with the emotional and physical trauma of that for life, innocent civilians killed. But something that is also the same, other than putting our troops in these positions, is that the same troops that respond in Beirut are the same ones that are blown off their feet at Abbey Gate. They get up or they hear the explosion from across the airfield, and all of these U.S. servicemen, and in the case of Abbey Gate, women, run to the sound of those explosions. They run to the sound of the guns, trying to save as many of their brothers and sisters in arms as they possibly can, trying to save as many innocent Afghan civilians as they possibly can in the case of Afghanistan. In the case of Beirut, they're digging through piles of rubble with their bare hands, with K-bar knives, with a shovel, maybe a crowbar if they can find one, trying to save as many lives as possible. And they're on the clock. The final person will be pulled from the rubble, a chaplain, 5 hours later. He is in complete darkness, can't move, two huge concrete walls give him just enough room to breathe. And as he's getting dug out, he feels them crushing him, even just slowly crushing him and restricting his ability to breathe. And he's a chaplain. He's having a conversation with God down there, an argument with God. And he's thinking about Louis L'Amour novels that he used to read about miners and cowboys trapped in cave-ins and how they had to dig their way out and come out fighting. So there are definitely parallels between Beirut 1983 and what we did in Afghanistan, and things that have happened between those two dates all around the world.
And I'm guessing, knowing your writing, and as somebody who's loved your books, there were lessons that we should have learned that we probably did not. Is that a fair assumption?
This is true, and one of the main ones is that those decisions that are made in the Oval Office, thousands of miles from a battlefield, they're going to have multi-generational impacts. So whoever's up there advising the president and that president better have an understanding of the nature of the conflict in which they're engaged or about to engage U.S. forces, because he is a decision maker at that top. And then there's a line of decision makers that works its way all the way down to an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid who's standing a post somewhere around the world, holding a rifle, off safe, finger on trigger, as a truck or a car approaches this checkpoint, and he's looking at it, or now these days, she's looking at it, wondering if it is laden with explosives or if it just has bad suspension. But that 18, 19, 20-year-old kid with that rifle is the final decision maker in a chain of decision makers that starts with the president of the United States. So before you commit that 18, 19, 20-year-old kid to that position, you better have a good reason.
It's remarkable. And because you're such a great writer, it's such a great storyteller, the book reads, it's got a very, the pace of a fiction book. It's got the pace of a novel, but of course it is a true story. Beirut, the 1983 Marine barracks bombing and the untold origin story of the war on terror. Jack Carr, my guest, the author, international best-selling author, and the man behind this incredible bottle of whiskey that he sent me, along with a wonderful box of cigars. I'm wearing his hat right now on YouTube. You can see it streaming live. Jack, there are a lot of parallels also to what's happening right now with Hezbollah and the IDF. Well, I had my friend, our mutual friend, Dr. Victoria Coates on earlier, and she told me that one of the people taken out by the IDF was one of the people behind the bombing of our barracks in Beirut. I did not know that. That's pretty remarkable.
That's right. And actually today, September 20th, 1984, there was another bombing that he was involved in of the embassy annex. So after our embassy was bombed in April of 1983, and then the headquarters and barracks of the Marines were bombed in October, then there were some different security parameters put in place. and the embassy annex moved, and it was hit on this day in 1984. And the person who was killed today by Israel had a hand in that as well. He was actually listed as a designated global terrorist in 2019. There was a $7 million reward for justice program out for him for any information leading to his location, and he was taken off the board today. So those seeds of violence were really planted in the early 80s, and that soil of Lebanon was extremely fertile back then.
What do you make of what the IDF is doing with the pagers and the phones? And I think it's remarkable how they're able to pull this off and really pinpoint target terrorists in doing so. But how do they have the capability, the technology to be able to do this?
Oh, it's incredible. It is remarkable. And it's been in the works, had to have been in the works for a while. And this is just my assessment with no inside information. But I remember studying a terrorist that they took out in, I believe, 1996. And I believe he was a Hamas bomb maker back in a time when a cell phone, if it kind of malfunctioned, you'd have to take it in to get repaired rather than just get a new one. Like today, they're kind of disposable today. Back then, they weren't. And so this guy goes in to get his phone repaired, comes out, unbeknownst to him, there's now an explosive in it. And it takes his head off. So they did that back in 1996. And now they're using pagers. And the reason, obviously, they're using pagers is because there's less that can be exploited from a technical intelligence standpoint. There's not a camera in there. There's no photos that you're taking and videos that you're taking and text messages and things that can be exploited. So that's why they're using pagers. It's not just popular in Lebanon. And they don't just have a fondness for 1980s and 1990s, Miami Vice episodes. They are using those because they are less susceptible to exploitation by technical intelligence capabilities of the Israelis and probably us as well. So that's why most of the bad guys have those. Most of the terrorists have those. Yeah. And it was a remarkable operation. You call it upstream disruption. So you do something upstream of someone getting a device that has now been tampered with and is now a weapon. And we saw it work with amazing results. And then they follow up with walkie-talkies the next day. So it is a remarkable operation. And this follows on the heels of, I don't know if you were following it, but there was a week ago, there was an Israeli special operations mission into Syria. I think they killed about 18 people, dozens wounded, but they were targeting a scientific research center that worked on precision-guided munitions that would allow Hezbollah to hit targets in Israel with more accuracy. And they hit it multiple times with airstrikes in the past. They couldn't get to it, so they sent in Israeli special operations who went inside and blew it up from the inside, took it out, took 2 to 4 Iranians captured is what I saw. And for the first time that I can recall, they used drones as a blocking force. So they go in, the Syrian reaction force goes to the site of this attack, and they use drones as what we would typically use or rangers for to block off an area while, let's say, a higher tier special operations unit goes in to do a mission like this. And they use drones instead of people for that. So it was quite remarkable. So they are on the warpath.
The book is Targeted Beirut, and it's all about the embassy bombings in 1983, the 1983 Marine Barracks bombing, and the untold origin story of the war on terror. Marine Barracks bombing, excuse me. The largest loss of life for the United States Marine Corps since Iwo Jima. And Jack Carr writing this book to make sure that their memory is not forgotten. I guess, as we're talking about this, and you mentioned Iran early on, Jack Carr, we're still talking about Iran right now, and Iran and their proxies, and the IDF is now in Lebanon. I mean, this book could not have come at a more apropos time. This region of the world is still on fire here, and I don't even really know the question I'm asking you, other than the fact of, how is it that we're talking about something that occurred in 1983 with parallels that are occurring right now in the year 2024?
Because we taught them, the enemy, Iran, through its proxies, that terrorism works. So in the wake of October 23rd, 1983, and this loss of life, we had a lot of tough talk out of the administration. But then we very quietly, or as quietly as one can, leave in early 1984. And so what did that teach Iran and its proxies and other terrorist organizations around the world? It taught them that terrorism works. And that's the model that they've been using ever since, is to attack the United States, to attack United States allies and interests around the world through proxy forces. And it has been quite effective for them.
At Jack Carr USA. Follow him on social at Jack Carr USA. Navy SEAL sniper, best-selling author, 2 Amazon Prime specials, and now the brand new book, Beirut. Terminalist Dark Wolf coming out very soon with Chris Pratt and Taylor Kitsch. And how many kills?
We've talked about this before. I thought you would have evolved. It's all about adaptation.
I can't help myself. I don't learn my own lessons, Jack Carr. I don't learn it, my friend. Listen, buddy, it's always great to talk to you. You're such a great guy. You're a hero, and you're a patriot, and you're incredibly talented. We're just so happy for your success. And if you were in studio with me, I would crack open this bottle of bourbon, but otherwise I'm going to save it till the next time we're together in person. But get the book, Beirut. This is a must-read. We're going to learn a lot about the origin story of the War on Terror. Jack, thank you so much, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me. Be careful with that whiskey. It's 125 proof. So, yeah, be warned.
I will heed your warning, my friend. Thank you.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
All right, so Dr. Mike Veneria is a great guy, great friend of the show, and the master of dental implants. He's going to give you the smile of your dreams. And you got to go see him today. Dr. Mike has been recognized among his peers as a master of dental implants for 12 consecutive years. 12 consecutive years, that's right. And you know what? Before you know it, it's going to be Christmas time, holiday pictures, everything that's going on. You want to make sure you have that beautiful smile. So get a free implant consultation. Go to VeneriaDental.com or call him at 856-786-2020. 856-786-2020. With two locations to serve you in Cinnaminson and Woodbury. Dental excellence unmatched with Dr. Mike Veneria. So what are you waiting for? Taking care of your smile is so important. If you need a dental implant, there's no one better. He is the master. VeneriaDental.com. 856-786-2020. Remember, he's my dentist too. Bridget just got a brand new smile from him. He's going to give you the smile of your dreams. VeneriaDental.com.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.